Yesterday, on October 20th, 2025, Arthur Waskow, a revolutionary activist and teacher of Torah, died at the age of 92. He was an inspiration to our work at Judaism Unbound in more ways than we can articulate. Even as our organization was launched when he was already in his 80s, he found so many ways to collaborate with us and offer his unique Torah to our audiences. He presented at 5 consecutive Shavuot live gatherings, again, in his late 80s and 90s, frequently moving attendees to tears. He welcomed Judaism Unbound as a partner for many of his programs with the Shalom Center and was twice a guest on this podcast. For those who would feel moved to hear from Arthur's voice shortly after his passing, we wanted to re-release those 2 appearances of his on Judaism Unbound. The first is episode 166, entitled The Freedom Seder, and the second is a bonus episode called Confronting Carbon Pharaohs. Even and especially at age 92, and throughout his life, Arthur Waskow was committed in mind, in spirit, and in body to the betterment of our world. He reminded us over and over that the word Adama, in Hebrew meaning soil or earth, and the word Adam, meaning earthling, or human being, are intertwined, meaning all of us as earthlings are inherently connected to the planet, Earth, that we live on, and to one another. May his memory be for a blessing and for a revolution. Without further ado, Arthur's blessing before studying Torah, and then these past 2 conversations with Arthur Waskow. Baruch atah Yah Eloheinu Ruach HaOlam Asher Kidshanu B'mitzvot V'tzivanu La'asok B'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, breath of all life, spirit of the world, who makes us holy through mitzvot and plants in us the desire to soak into words of Torah.
This is Judaism Unbound, episode 166, The Freedom Seder. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
Arthur Waskow is a rabbi today, but he didn't start out that way. In the 1960s, he was an activist who was writing, speaking, involving himself in electoral politics and nonviolent action against the Vietnam War. He was the co-author of a manifesto called A Call to Resist Illegitimate Authority, which supported those who resisted the military draft during the Vietnam War. As we'll discuss in the podcast, during the time of upheaval of the late 1960s, he started to see connections between what was going on in America during that difficult time and the Judaism that he actually wasn't all that immersed in before, but he started to have inklings that there was really something there. And his journey started by the creation of this thing called the Freedom Seder, which we'll talk about, but it had to do with bringing the Jewish experience of slavery and freedom into dialogue with the African-American experience of slavery and freedom. Arthur Waskow went on to become one of the leaders of the Jewish Renewal Movement, and in 1983, he founded the Shalom Center, where he continues to serve as director. Initially, the Shalom Center was focused on the threat of nuclear war from a Jewish perspective, and lately, it's turned its focus to issues of climate change and care for the earth. In 1995, Arthur Waskow was eventually ordained as a rabbi. He's written many important books, including God Wrestling in 1978, the book Seasons of Our Joy about the Jewish holidays in 1982, and he co-authored The Tent of Abraham in 2006. Well into his 80s, Arthur Waskow continues his social activism today. We're absolutely thrilled to have him on Judaism Unbound. Arthur Waskow, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a great thrill and honor to have you.
Thank you. Shalom, salam, paz to all your listeners of whatever culture and community.
Well, thank you so much. I know that you wanted to start our conversation in a particular way, so let's give you the opportunity to do that before we ask our first question.
Okay. So the tradition teaches that when people together learn Torah with and from each other, they say a bracha, affirming the process as a sacred process. One of my friends and teachers, Ari Alon, understood Talmud as a collection of the spiritual searchings of a couple of thousand, maybe more than a couple of thousand folks who became or were called rabbis or not. Why, I asked, did he think they insisted on this bracha? He said, well, I think that they realized you could get addicted to Torah study, and they didn't think that was a good idea. They told themselves the story of forgetting to give tzedakah because you were so busy learning Torah, not forgetting to pray three times a day, not forgetting to go home and make love to your wife. There were almost all the three or four of them were men. And so he thought they were trying to remind themselves that learning Torah was a mitzvah among the mitzvot. It was part of the whole interwoven. And for me, one of the stories of the rabbis that for me speaks most to that lesson is the story of Akiba and several other rabbis hiding from the Roman army in an attic, right? And they start exploring what should you risk your life for that the Romans had outlawed. Should you risk your life to study Torah or risk your life to do acts of Torah? And finally, Akiba says, which is greater, study or action? Study if it leads to action. Certainly, that's my hope about Torah study. I love it in itself, and I most love it when it results in action. So I do want to do the bracha, but with not all the same words that they did it with. And I have to explain that, and it's a kind of paradox. I'm going to have to explain some Torah before doing the bracha that you're supposed to do before you explore Torah. When I was 11 and learning Hebrew from my grandmother, she taught me ba, bo, be, and then words, and then sentences, and then we came to a sentence that had yud, he, lo, he in the Western alphabet. YHWH would be the transliteration. And she said, that's Adonai. I said, Grandmom, you just taught me the letter for N, the N sound, the Nun, and you just taught me the letter for the Dalet, the D sound, and they're not there, can't be. She said, I know, just do it. So for the biggest hunk of my life, when I got serious enough about being Jewish to do it at all, I did it. And then I was in the middle of a class at Swarthmore College that was supposed to be about Martin Buber. One of his books, brilliant book, called Moses. It's a kind of theological biography of Moses. And somebody once asked Buber why he did it. And he said, well, I'm trying all my life to have a conversation with God. Clear that Moses had a great conversation with God. I thought if I could listen in on Moses' conversation with God, it would improve my own conversation with God. And we come to a chapter called The Words on the Tablets. Of course, it's about Sinai. And Buber doesn't start with the first two words. Anochi, which is this elevated Hebrew word for I. It's not the ordinary Hebrew word for I, but it's an elevated word. The whole universe is speaking. It says, I, Anochi. And the next one is the Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, the YHWH. So I said, well, Professor Buber, you are a rebel and I'm a rebel. And I wonder what would happen if I tried pronouncing what's really written. It doesn't have any vowels, so it's not Yahweh, despite what they teach in comparative religion courses. And it's not Jehovah, it's just the four letters with no vowels. So I tried pronouncing it. And what came out was, it was a breath. And I was so startled. The first thing that came to me was, so that makes sense. at least one of the real names of the real God shouldn't be just in Hebrew or Egyptian or Greek or Roman or Latin or English or Chinese or Swahili, but in all of them. The only sound that really is in every human language is simply breathing. That was my first thought. My second one was, oh, it's not just human beings. All life on this planet breathes. And what's more, they don't breathe in little bubbles like this, sort of, but back and forth. Every animal on the planet, including human beings, breathes in the oxygen that every plant on the planet breathes out, and we then breathe out CO2, carbon dioxide, and the plants breathe that in. So the notion of yud, hey, vav, hey, as the interbreathing of all life on Earth appealed to me a great deal more than king, lord, judge, and all that stuff up there, and us poor schleppers down here. Okay, so now, having done all this Torah before saying the bracha that you're supposed to say before you do Torah, now let me say it in English first and then in Hebrew. Blessed are you, the breathing spirit of the world, the breath of all life, who breathes into us the human impulse to shape our breath into words, and the desire that you breathe into us to shape our words so that they aim for wisdom, becoming our own words of Torah. Baruch atah Eloheinu Ruach Ha'olam Asher Kitchanu B'mizvot B'tzivanu La'asuch B'divrei Torah. And together,
Amen.
Say,
Amen.
Amen. Now we have to begin.
Well, thank you for starting us off on the most elevated plane that we've ever started a podcast off on. So I feel like we've just had an introduction to the Arthur Wasko of 2019, and I'd love to take us back to the Arthur Wasko of 1969, because the way that we ended up having this episode was that I was actually facilitating a panel at the Council of American Jewish Museums conference in Los Angeles a few months ago. And what happened was that I was talking about a recent interview that we had done with Jonathan Safran Foer, who was talking about the Haggadah that he put together, the New American Haggadah. And we were talking about that on the panel, and somebody said, almost like, making your own Haggadah is a commonplace. I mean, everybody does that. And I said, wait a second. I mean, everybody hasn't done that for all that long. I mean, I don't know when the first person who did it was, but you know, maybe it was Arthur Wasko with the Freedom Seder. I don't know. And then somebody on the panel, who was actually the CEO of the National Museum of American Jewish History, said, actually, it's the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Seder, and we're doing a whole exhibit. So it turns out that Lex and I had kind of left the episode for the evening that Passover starts, which is today, the day that this podcast is being released. We had left that open for us to kind of have a conversation where we would look back at a bunch of episodes that we've done and also talk about Passover. But we realized that, wait, it would be better to have you on to talk about Passover and specifically to talk about this 50th anniversary of the Freedom Seder that you created in 1969, which, whether or not it was the first time somebody had written their own Haggadah, it certainly was a very momentous time. And it was one that I think has, and I think it was one that somehow liberated American Jews to feel that that was something that we do. So I would love to hear the story from you about how the Freedom Seder came to be, what it was exactly, and also kind of who you were at the time that you put it together.
Okay, let me just say, it was not the first time that Jews created their own Haggadah. It was the first time that evidently any Jew wove into the Haggadah a non-Jewish story. Mm. Like kibbutzim had done Haggadot that wove in the creation of the State of Israel, the liberation moment, but nobody had ever had the chutzpah, I think holy chutzpah, to involve another liberation struggle beside a Jewish one. So how did that happen? So looking back, I think this one seed was planted in 1964 at the Atlantic City Convention of the Democratic Party. There came from Mississippi an insurgent group. They call themselves the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. It was racially integrated. It was elected unofficially, mostly by people voting in churches, because the state of Mississippi beat you up and came close to and sometimes killed people for trying to register to vote. Killed black people for trying to register to vote. So these folks had come up. It was part of the great summer, Freedom Summer of 1964, had come up with a delegation to the Democratic National Convention, and they wanted to be seated as the real Mississippi Democrats, not the white segregationist, all-white delegation that came year after year. So they invited, well, back a step. To get recognized, they had to convince 10 members of the Credentials Committee to vote for them. It would then go to the floor of the convention, and on prime time, there would be this big debate, which Lyndon Johnson, President of the United States, was absolutely horrified. He was afraid he would lose his home state, Texas, if this, and the chair of the delegation was a sharecropper woman who had been beaten within an inch of her life for trying to register to vote officially, Fannie Lou Hamer. She was incredibly eloquent, and he didn't want her on national television. All right. So, but meanwhile, Fannie Lou Hamer led us picketing the convention on the boardwalk, the famous Atlantic City boardwalk. And as we picketed, she led us in singing. And one of the songs she sang went like this. Go tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere. Go tell it on the mountain to let my people go. A black song about the ancient Exodus, right? And that was the first glimmer for me that the story of the Exodus was not just a Jewish story. For that period of my life, from after my bar mitzvah until then, which was my bar mitzvah was in 1946, and it was boring and stupid. It was about the creation of the world, the first passage of the Torah, and nobody talked to me about that. About the creation, about Adam and Eve, about Cain and Abel, none of that. All they wanted, I should learn to chant it right. So when I was finished, I thought, well, that was really dumb. And I stopped being interested in Jewish practice, except for one thing, the Passover Seder. Because that was about freedom and justice. I grew up in a family of activists. So that point in my life, the only Jewish practice I'm interested in is Passover. Fine. On March 31st, Sunday, 1968, Lyndon Johnson goes on television, and all of us peace activists are expecting he's going to announce that he's sending another 100,000 troops to Vietnam. Instead, he says, it's over. I'm not going to run for re-election, and I'm going to send Avril Harriman, a great diplomat, to Paris to talk with people who up till that moment the United States had pretended didn't even exist, the Vietnamese government and the Vietnamese National Liberation Front. And until that moment, we figured we were the outsiders. I mean, the President of the United States was going to win, yeah? We were a protest delegation, anti-war, anti-racist. Our chair was a young black minister who was kind of a younger version of Martin Luther King. So we weren't going to win, but the president quits, his delegation becomes Hubert Humphrey's delegation, and Robert Kennedy announces he's running for president. So we committed ourselves to support Bobby Kennedy until Bobby was killed, just as King had been. And at that point, the question was what we were going to do. We decided to name Reverend Channing Phillips, the chair of our delegation, as black minister, to nominate him for president. And we did in the famous, infamous disaster, National Democratic Convention in Chicago in 68. And he got not only DC's votes, but the votes of some other Kennedy orphans. Okay. The convention was a fiasco. Demonstrators were beaten up on the streets of Chicago, and we were still stuck with a war and still stuck with racism, which the symbol of was the killing of Dr. King. And I came back home from being a delegate at the convention to Washington, and I felt like every one of my identities had been shattered, except for one. And that was the one that I didn't even know was real. And then came the first night of Passover. And as I said, that was the only serious Jewish practice in my life. So I walked home getting ready to get ready for the Seder. That meant walking past the army. And it meant walking ultimately past a Jeep with a machine gun pointed at the block I lived on. So my kishkas, my innards, my guts, more than my brain, began to say, this is Pharaoh's army. I'm going home to do the Seder of liberation from Pharaoh. And this is Pharaoh's army on the street. And I had always taken the Seder seriously, but this was like discovering a volcano, not even in your backyard, but in your own body, that was now exploding. There's a line in the traditional Haggadah that says, in every generation, every human being, it says, Kol Adam, every human being, not every Jew, must look upon himself, herself, as if we go forth from slavery to freedom in our generation. And I had read that ever since I was old enough to read, but I never paid any attention. It was another line. That night, however, it was clear what it meant. We were living it. I sat down with the Haggadah, the telling of the story of liberation from Egypt, in one hand, the copy I was given when I turned 13 as a bar mitzvah president. And in the other hand, Dr. King, Gandhi, Nat Turner, the leader of the slave rebellion, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, diary of Emanuel Gringelblum in my left hand. And I wove the left hand into the right hand. I wove those teachings into the Haggadah. And when I tried to figure out where to put them in the Haggadah, I thought that the debate that's in the Haggadah between the rabbis, whether they're 10 plagues or 20 plagues or 200 plagues or 500 plagues, I thought it was silly. So I created a debate that stretched across continents and centuries between violence and nonviolence as a way of getting freedom. That, I think, to me was a really serious debate to have on Passover. And I wove in a lot of the Black liberation struggle. I wasn't really making choices. I'd written 3 books by then, but it felt like this book was writing me, not me writing the book. So half of my friends said, Bosco, that is amazing. That's wonderful. And the other half said, you can't do that. There is a Haggadah. Nobody can write a Haggadah. Nobody. So when I finished what I figured was the first draft, I thought, I better check with some serious, knowledgeable Jew as to whether this is totally crazy or useful. I asked around. I got the name of a young rabbi in Washington, Earl White, also Olive Shalom, who was against the Vietnam War and public about it and was pro-civil rights and public about that, because I figured it didn't make sense even to try this out on anybody who wasn't. So I called him up. I explained what I was doing. And I asked him if he would give me a really frank assessment of what I'd done. He said, well, sounds interesting. Send it to him. So I did. A week later, he calls up. He says, Bosco, I love it. It's a midrash, an activist midrash on the Haggadah. And it's such an activist midrash. I wonder whether you know the ancient midrash I'm not translating it because I didn't know how to translate it. In a minute, I'll tell you. But the activist Midrash that said God wouldn't split the Red Sea until an activist walked in up to his nose, ready to drown. That's when God split the sea. So I wonder, because you're a Midrash, this is a Midrash, I wonder. And I said, what's a Midrash? He assumed, at least, that I must know this key word. A Midrash is a reinterpretation of Torah. The rabbis 2,000 years ago taught that the Torah is not written in black ink on white parchment. It's written in black fire on white fire. And it's relatively easy to read the black fire, the letters, but it's hard but necessary to learn to read the white fire, the blank spaces. We would say blank spaces, but they're not blank, said the rabbi. Just got to learn to read them. So that story about the guy who had to walk into the sea before God would split it, that's a Midrash. And here, Harold White was telling me that I, of all people, totally new to this whole thing, could write Midrash. So that's what convinced me this was a direction I needed to take. First of all, there was the politics of liberation in the Seder. And secondly, there was this totally delicious, weird notion that you could take an ancient text and give it a twirl, and it would come out somewhere totally new. And not only that the rabbis could do that 2,000 years ago, but he was saying, I could do it, and I had done it. So that appealed to my intellect, as well as my pishkes, as well as my gut. And that's what drew me deeper and deeper and deeper. So that has governed the rest of my life. It's 50 years now. I'm 85 now. So 35 years of my life, I was basically not very interested. And for 50 years, I've been passionately engaged.
Hearing that backstory for the Freedom Seder, look, I already felt deeply attached to this ritual that you brought to Judaism into the world, but to have that there and to really understand the depth and the years that went into its creation is spectacular. And more than that, I really want to hold and cherish the fact that you didn't know what Midrash meant and that you were not, people think of you, Rabbi Arthur Waskow. You are now Rabbi Arthur Waskow, Reb Arthur to many people. You were not a rabbi, and not only weren't you a rabbi in 1969, you weren't a rabbi for a long, long time after that.
Right.
So you, to use a term we use on this show positively all the time, you had a lot of chutzpah, and just I it really is so important to highlight that fact, and the fact that you were not coming into this with, I mean, forget tons of Jewish background, with any experience in recent years. I mean, you mentioned that your bar mitzvah at age 13 was really not a particularly interesting encounter for you. So I want to name that, and I want to reflect back to you, because what you did in creating the Freedom Seder is so. On the one hand, there's all of the obvious and super important things that you did to create. To create a connection that was already there between the story of the Exodus and fights for justice. I mean, it's apparent in the text, but nobody had taken this. I don't mean to discredit you, but like, it's a basic but important step to make that connection. People hadn't done it so explicitly yet. And so you did that, and there's all these people that have built on that over the years, and that's good. But what you, I mean, it's really good. It's astoundingly good. But what you also did is you created a permission for people to play with ritual. And to this day, we have not gotten there fully on other Jewish rituals. I mean, to this day, the Passover Seder, we are ahead in terms of people who make their own Haggadahs, who go to websites and create templates and who share videos and who do all. I mean, we're ahead on Passover, I think, largely due to what you did. So I'd love to just ask you, entering back into that Arthur Waskow of many decades ago, who was not Rabbi Arthur Waskow, What compelled you to have that chutzpah, to a certain extent give yourself that permission, but also ask permission of a rabbi? And how could people, how could Jews, how could the world learn from that impulse and apply it in fights for justice and fights for the future of Judaism?
I had no plan. It would never have entered my mind that hundreds, thousands of Jews would respond by writing their own Haggadahs. That there would be a feminist Haggadah within a year or a year and a half. That there were environmental Haggadahs. That there were Haggadahs built around the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina. The mothers searching for their children who had been arrested, mostly killed by the military junta in Argentina. I had no idea that that could happen. So I didn't have a plan. I just had an impulse. And it felt like a holy impulse. That's all I can say. It felt like an impulse to heal, not to destroy. So what can I say about it? I can only say, if even with a tiny, tiny connection to a piece of the tradition, something opened itself to speak, opened one's own self to hearing it and enriching it and teaching it and saying it. It's much broader now, even beyond Pesach. It's much broader now that there's a connection, Bridgewater understood, that there's a connection, should be, can be, a connection between what we used to think of as only ritual and ceremony and Tikkun Olam, the healing of the world. And that those things do not need to be separated as they were for a very long time. People now do see. I was sitting in my backyard about 8 or 10 years ago, thinking about the climate question and about oil. And I muttered to myself, I wish there were a Jewish holiday that was about conserving oil. And then it was like one of the trees in the backyard practically yelled at me, Wasco, what's wrong with you? There he is, a Jewish holiday about conserving oil. It's Hanukkah. And that whole legend about one day's worth of oil worked for 8 days. Whoops. Now, so actually the Shalom Center did things with that. Now, it's not just the Shalom Center. People have absorbed the idea to think about Hanukkah as a climate, carbon question, right? The notion that there is a connection, a deep unity connection between what we often call ritual and what we often call politics, Tikkun Olam. That is now much broader than it was. And, you know, I think to myself, if you have a super saturated solution and you drop a crystal in, just a bare tiny crystal, the whole solution can turn into crystal. And I think that's what I was in 1968. The Jewish youth of 1968 were a super saturated solution. The 60s had turn people inside out, upside down, or downside up, maybe. And the creation of the early Havalot, the fellowship, which were much more deep, not centered around a rabbi, capital R, but a community, that was already cooking. And I think, I don't know, of course, but I wouldn't have been surprised if in some alternate history, somebody else had done something like the Freedom Service, because I think that the energy was absolutely there.
So I want to pick up on a few things that you just talked about. First of all, I want to note that when Purim happened a few weeks ago, I actually tried to write a new version of the Megillah for my family and some friends because, well, for various reasons. And it actually kind of wrote itself when I was trying to sort of transpose the story to a story of our own times with a buffoonish, amoral ruler. My proudest moment was that when he couldn't sleep, I had Kellyanne Conway sit and read him his old tweets. But what happened as it was writing itself was that the villain turned out to be a Jew, Stephen Miller. And that was kind of something that I'm still kind of pondering and thinking about. But I actually thought that maybe you could help us connect two different time periods to connect our time to the 60s and to connect our time perhaps to the dawn of rabbinic Judaism in the following way. Like I think that our time, you know, sometimes when you describe the 60s, as terrible as I feel like our time is, there are ways in which I'm like, oh, wow, it was even worse back then. So I don't know if it was worse then or worse now, but it feels like we're talking about two times that are pretty awful. And I've been thinking a lot recently about my own sense as an American and feeling that I feel like my own faith as an American has been shattered in a way that my faith in God sort of never was, because I don't think I quite had it in quite that way that it felt shattering. There were different feelings that went along with that, but I feel like I can almost identify with that experience in the sense that my faith in America has been shattered. And not only in the sense that it feels like something has happened now that broke it, but something that happened now actually opened my eyes to the fact that it's always been broken for people that I love and care about very much, people of color and others. And to realize, so what's shattering about it is sort of to realize that it never really was. And that, I feel like there are ways in which what was going on in the 60s and the 70s is actually very connected to what's going on now. And I'd love for you to reflect on it. It's and also on what the differences are. And I know that you have been focused very much on new pharaohs and new things to be concerned about, particularly the earth. And it would be great to sort of understand that. But the other time period that I want to connect this to, and I'm thinking about the book that you wrote, Seasons of Our Joy, about the Jewish holidays. By the way, you wrote that also before you were a rabbi. And so I think it's important for our listeners to hear that.
You can write books. I knew what Midrash was.
Right. Yeah. But you can write books about, even books about Judaism and not be a rabbi. But one of the questions that I have about that is kind of when we go back to access the ancient tradition of Judaism, the ancient ideas, how do we think about what remains relevant? You know, to what extent we should be drawing on those wells and saying, you know, hey, actually, the rabbis or the Torah had some ideas in it that are actually still very, very resonant. And we may have to do a midrash, but we still can reach back for that. Those ancients were smart. They understood humanity. They understood the experience. And to what extent do we say, no, we're in a new paradigm? You know, you're part of the Jewish Renewal Movement, which is about a paradigm shift. And how do we say, you know, there are also times when we can look back at those ancient wells and say they don't have what we need, and we actually have to engage in the process of creation and reinvention ourselves?
I think we're in a very dark time now. In some ways, not as openly, violently dark as the 60s and 70s were, but the 60s especially. But in some ways worse, because even Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon did not have as their goals the dismantling of the whole democratic process in the United States. And I think we now have a president who does. Who doesn't like it, doesn't live with it, doesn't affirm it, and doesn't allow it wherever he can get away with not allowing it. About the uses of the ancient text, story, and experience. There's one element in it I think is incredibly important now. And again, you have to do midrash on how to deal with it. But the folks who created what we call the Hebrew Bible were really close to the earth. And rabbinic Judaism, because it lost that closeness to the earth, has created some distortions which still exist. I mean, they're like laudable distortions. Like, given that Jewish thought focused on how you built rabbinically, how you built a decent Jewish community internally, right? Then with the emancipation in at least Western Europe, the question became, so how do you expand that into social justice for the whole society? Well, what I keep finding is that social justice has been where that process so far has gotten stuck for most, even the best of the Jewish organizations. I don't like it that the Shalom Center is the only national Jewish organization that sees the planet and the climate crisis as priority number one. I mean, I believe we do, but I wish others did. So looking back, I've written a lot about how the Torah, and broader than the Torah, the prophets and the writings, are so loving of the land and so interested about healing the land from not to overdo, not to make the land overwork. I mean, the whole chapter of Leviticus, the word Shemitah, release, letting the land be released from working for us 1 year out of every seven. Adam and Adama, the best translation, which hardly anybody uses, though I've been trying to, is earth, that's Adama, and earthling, which is a specialized word in English for a human being. And Adam means human, and Adama means earth in Hebrew. The two are totally intertwined, and we are intertwined. So earth and earthling, or maybe human and humus. But the trouble is, humus is a very specialized kind of earth, and earthling, up till now, has been woo-woo word for Star Wars. So I think we need to draw on that wisdom. I taught a course a couple summers ago about, quote, prayer as if the earth really matters. And one of the things we worked out was that for the Amida prayer, the murmured, not totally silent, but not out loud prayer, what we did was go outside to a grove of trees, and each person in the minyan, in the small congregation, went to a tree. And the instruction or invitation was to listen to the tree's prayer. And for the Amida, each of us shared the tree's prayer that we had heard. I think trees really need to count in the minyan. You couldn't have a minyan unless the trees were breathing so that we could have a minyan. I once had a wonderful, I was invited to teach a course by one of the synagogues here to 12-year-olds preparing for bar and bat mitzvah about the earth, about a Jewish way of seeing the earth, eco-Judaism. So along the way, we read that very brief verse in Deuteronomy that says, even or especially when you're at war, you can't destroy the trees of your enemy, the fruit trees of your enemy, right? So we read that and we talked about it a little. And then I asked these 12-year-olds what they had learned about trees in public school, aside from any Jewish school. And they instantly, all of them had learned that trees give out oxygen and we need to breathe it in. So I said, well, so the Torah says you can't cut down a fruit tree. If all the trees are giving oxygen that we need to live, does that mean they're all fruit trees? And if they are, does that mean we can't cut any of them down? So the kids had a whole discussion of them their own. I kept my mouth shut after I asked the question. And finally, one of them said, I don't think we could say that we can't cut down any trees. What we can say is, every time you cut down a tree, you have to plant a new one. And I say, you have just joined the process of the Beit Din making halacha, making Jewish law. What you have just done is you have weighed actually two goods rather than two bads against each other. A lot of the Jewish law is based on how you weigh two values that are valuable. And you have come up with a really interesting answer.
I feel like it would be a loss for us not to go in one more direction before we go, which is to visit your decades of experience around Israel-Palestine. And I wanted to bring that in, A, because you've been echoing beautifully this whole episode how so many pieces that we consider separate are actually intertwined. But I know from your work that politics around Israel-Palestine are interwoven with all of these politics of the earth and all of these Jewish ritual understandings that you've brought to the fore. And I also I'm part of the organization, if not now, which takes as a given the premise that you really popularized through the Freedom Seder, that a Jewish ritual can, and even in some situations must, incorporate calls for justice, etc. And that's why If Not Now has, in its organizing around Israel-Palestine, done all sorts of Jewish ritual actions. And so I wanted to pose for you, how do questions around Israel-Palestine interact with the issues that we've talked about so far? What other issues might arise for us and challenges for us as Jews and as human beings? And what have your decades through organizations like Brera, through organizations like New Jewish Agenda, through more contemporary work that you've continued to do, even into your 80s, what can that do to inform those of us who are a little younger than that? In the grand scheme, not all that much younger. We're very close in the grand scheme of human history. But how can we integrate Israel-Palestine into these conversations as well?
So first of all, I totally love the way If Not Now goes about it, because I do think that it re-enlivens Judaism in the process of critiquing much of what we have come to just assume was Judaism. All right, so my first serious connection with Israel and with Palestine came in the summer of 1969, a couple of months after the Freedom Seder. I spent the summer because my then wife had close relatives who had founded a kibbutz in the Negev. At that point, 1969, the occupation was only 2 years old. You could argue that it was a mild occupation. But I was an historian. I know that no occupation stays mild forever. So the occupation gets tighter and tougher, and the resistance gets more and more intense and more violent, perhaps. So I came back to the United States after the summer, and I put together a group of Jews and some non-Jews, including Benjamin Spock, who, if people don't remember, was like the granddaddy of all America. He had written this amazing childcare book. So we put together, I think, the first public statement in the United States for a two-state peace. We published it in the New York Review of Books. Couldn't afford to publish it in that time. And Brera emerged in the early 70s and got smashed by slanderous attacks. New Jewish Agenda emerged out of the wreckage of Brera and took on a whole multi-issue, not just Israel-Palestine, but a whole set of issues facing the Jewish community. Where I'm at now, in thinking about it and writing about it, I wrote a piece for Tikkun on the 50th anniversary of the occupation. What has come to me more and more as what for me, and I would say for Torah, is a crucial way of thinking about the question, is about the nature of idolatry. There are two stories in the Talmud that I really love about idolatry. One is, remember, they're living under the Roman occupation. One is a Jew comes to a rabbi and says, I just bought a house from a Roman. It's a beautiful house, and it's got a pool behind it that's beautiful. And at the end of the pool is a statue of a naked woman. I'm worried. Is that Venus, the Roman goddess? And if so, do I have to tear the statue down? So the rabbi says, it depends. If the pool was there and the statue was sculpted to adorn it, it's a statue. You don't have to tear it down. If the statue was there and the pool was dug to adore the statue, then the statue's an idol and you got to tear it down. So it's clear it's not the physical thing, it's the attitude you bring to it. The other story I love is that a group of the rabbis decided to try to find the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse for idolatry. They thought if they could find it, they could kill it, then there would be no more idolatry in the world. So they hunt and they hunt and they hunt. And they finally found it. It was in the Holy of Holies at the heart of the temple, which says to me that teaching is you can make the most sacred practice, the most sacred place, the most sacred anything. You can make it into an idol. You have to choose not to. It seems to me some Jews, both in Israel and in the United States, have made an idol out of the government of Israel and even out of the state. It's one thing to see the state as a context for protecting Jews who were in trouble wherever else they lived, as a context for growing a whole new Jewish culture with novelists and filmmakers who are wonderful, a context for reawakening Hebrew as a language, a context for holy work. It's another thing to say you cannot criticize what its government wants to do, and you can't for sure criticize the existence of an allegedly Jewish state. For me, at this point in my life, anyway, that's the most profound issue. Idolatry, the ease of falling into it, the dangers of falling into it.
I'm just sort of sitting here wondering what, you know, 34-year-old Arthur Wasko would have made of 85-year-old Arthur Wasko, and to some extent, the values are the same. And I'm curious about how you would have heard the Jewish language in which you're speaking. And my sense is that you would have heard it well. And I guess I also want to call that out for our listeners as this conversation is an example of somebody who, you know, has changed a lot over the course of the last 50 years and added a lot to your quiver, but nevertheless can speak in a language that the younger you would have been able to hear. And I applaud that, and I wish that you know, we'd see a lot more of that. I just want to close by also saying that when I asked a close friend of mine whether she knew you, she said, "Well, I don't really know him, but I shared a paddy wagon with him once." She said, "You know, you really haven't arrived as a Jew unless you've shared a paddy wagon with Arthur Wasko." And I feel like Lex and I have not yet shared a paddy wagon with you. So true. I want to bless us all on going out, as you blessed us coming in, that we should all live long and be able to share a paddy wagon one day, standing up for what we believe in.
I would be delighted. Amen.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic.
All right. Thank you for this. Thank you for raising questions, some of which I have addressed in the past and some of which I haven't. Thanks very much.
This is a special bonus episode of Judaism Unbound, Confronting Carbon Pharaohs. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are thrilled to release this midweek bonus episode in a different format than usual. In our last core episode, we talked with Madeline Canfield and Nate DeGroot, two of the organizers of a project called the Exodus Alliance. But we thought it would be a big missed opportunity if we didn't also offer an episode featuring the project's founder, Arthur Wasko, who was our guest back on episode 166. Today's bonus episode isn't an interview. Instead, we wanted to give Arthur Wasko the chance to speak from the heart about his creation of the Freedom Seder over 50 years ago and the work he continues to do today, connecting the observance of Passover to working against the threat of climate catastrophe. We hope that listening to his prophetic words will inspire you as you gear up for this coming Passover, and as we all seek to channel Jewish holiday observance toward the creation of a better, more just world. So without further ado, we'll pass the mic to the founder of the Freedom Seder and the director of the Shalom Center, Arthur Wasko.
Shalom Aleichem. We're in the period between Purim and Pesach. My theory has been that Purim was an attempt to limit kings and tyrants by making fun of them. But if that didn't work, then we would have to do Pesach and invoke all the energy of the breath of life, the wind of change, even a hurricane of transformation. So that's where we are, and we're looking toward Pesach. I think I'd like to begin just by saying the bracha for Torah study, though I wish there were a whole group of people we could study Torah together with. But even if I'm just alone in talking, you'll be a group of people and listening. So, Ruach Atah, Yah. Eloheinu, Ruach HaOlam, Asher Kitchanu B'mitzvot, V'tzivanu La'asok B'divrei Torah. And I'll say Amen to myself. Thinking about Pesach and what we're doing this year that's different brings me back really to the beginning of my Jewish life and certainly to the beginning of my becoming Yisrael, wrestling with God 53 years ago now, 1968, Martin Luther King was murdered, which moved me deeply. I had met him once, and the whole movement to transform America to be a fuller democracy had engaged me, moved me. Not especially Jewishly. There was only one piece of Jewish practice that I was really passionate about, and that was the Passover Seder. It was about freedom and justice. And I grew up in a household where those were important, and the Seder was therefore important. Well, it turned out that Dr. King being murdered came just a week before Passover in 1968. And that week, the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, responded to an uprising from the Black community in anger, fury, and frustration by sending the U.S. Army into Washington to occupy the city. And he proclaimed a curfew, which in theory applied to everybody, but the police didn't care if whites were on the streets. So they mobilized to close down the Black neighborhoods. And a bunch of us, whites, civil rights, and anti-war activists, created what we called the Center for Emergency Support to get food and medicine, and lawyers and doctors into the Black community, which otherwise was totally cut off by the curfew. So that's what I was doing for a week, day and night. But then came the first night of Passover. So I walked home to get ready to do the Seder. That meant walking past the army. And when I got to the block I lived on, it meant walking past the Jeep with a machine gun aimed at the block I lived on. My kishkes, my innards, my guts, more than my brain, began to say, "This is Pharaoh's army, and you're going home to celebrate liberation from Pharaoh." And that moment changed my life. It changed the Seder, which became for me a kind of volcano in my backyard that I hadn't even known existed. I'd always been serious about it, but the line which is in every traditional Haggadah, in every generation, every human being, it says, "Kol Adam," not every Jew, every human being should look upon himself, herself, as if we go forth from slavery to freedom, not our great, 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 great grandparents only. I'd read that line ever since I was old enough to read, but it hadn't meant very much. But that night, it meant everything, really. it meant the streets were in the Seder and the Seder was in the streets. So I found myself later that year called, really, it felt like a call, to write what became the Freedom Seder, to connect the ancient liberation struggle of the Jewish people with the modern liberation struggle, ongoing still then, still now, of Black America and of other communities struggling for freedom. I learned what a midrash was, and that what I was doing was midrash, that I was taking an ancient text, not only the Haggadah for Passover, but ancient biblical texts, and transforming them, reading them with new eyes. And that was midrash, and I could do it. And it was traditional to do it, but it had mostly gotten frozen several centuries ago. So that brings me to now. Here we are. We're facing the greatest, deepest, most urgent crisis in the history of the human race. The crisis of whether large parts of the web of life that we have lived with as a species since our beginning are going to survive. Whether even the human species is going to survive the climate crisis that human beings have invented. We have choked the breathing of the earth. The breathing of the earth depends on the exchange of oxygen and CO2 between plants and animals, back and forth. We animals breathe in oxygen and breathe out CO2. The plants of the earth breathe in the CO2, use it to build themselves, and then breathe out oxygen. But part of the human race, I call them corporate carbon pharaohs, big oil, gas, coal corporations, burn fossil fuels so profusely that we send so much CO2 into the atmosphere that not all the trees and bushes and plants and grasses of planet Earth can turn them back into oxygen, which means they build up and build up and build up, and they're heat-trapping gases. People call them greenhouses, but that's a nice name. They trap heat, and the planet is getting hotter and hotter. And the result of getting hotter and hotter are plagues. Plagues of fire, plagues of flood, plagues of famine, where the food crops fail. The reason I call them corporate carbon pharaohs is that they behave like Pharaoh. For their own power and their own wealth and their own enormous hyper wealth, they're prepared to burn up the earth. And just as Pharaoh's stubbornness and arrogance and cruelty was prepared to burn up his own country. So that's what a Pharaoh is. The Pharaoh thought he was God. He didn't realize that enslaving human beings would mean that the earth itself would rise up against them. That's what the plagues were. So here we are at a moment of deep crisis. And the U.S. government, which is one of the most important to act on this, because the U.S. has the per capita, the highest, and per nation, one of the two or three highest emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere. So what the U.S. government does is really important. But the U.S. government is paralyzed. Why is it paralyzed? Because the corporate carbon pharaohs have enough power to make a deadlock. The first half of that word, deadlock, was more important even than the second half, the locked part. We're locked into death by this paralysis. Until and unless the people of the United States can change their government, a majority of them, a big majority, are committed to deal with the climate crisis. They know it exists. They don't think it's a fake, but they have not been able yet to make the political majority. There's a popular majority, a majority of the people, but there are elements of the Constitution that were deliberately set up to prevent a simple democratic majority of the people from making decisions. Systematic breaks against democratic decision making. So some of us decided that there needs to be another way to mobilize what Moses and Aaron and Miriam mobilized, maybe Shifra and Pua, the midwives who refused to obey Pharaoh's order to murder every Israelite baby boy. And what we need is a movement. We don't need a single family like Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. We need a much broader movement. And we need, since what's making the pharaohs possible is, at this point, money they have to borrow from big banks like Chase Bank and from big pools of money set up to make investments. Some of them are making investments in burning the earth, our home, the only home we have. They're investing in arson, to tell the truth, investing in murder as well as arson. So 6 months ago, more even, maybe, I looked ahead to see when the major festivals like Passover were going to be. And it turned out, to my surprise and interest, that Passover, the Christian Holy Week, and Ramadan, the sacred month-long daytime fast with breaking of the fast each evening, is also in April, as it turned out, both Passover, Pesach, and Holy Week were. And then I thought, hey, maybe we can bring together the religions for which the Exodus is important. A big hunk, maybe a fourth or a fifth of the Quran is about the Exodus. So at least those three religious traditions could perhaps work together to deal with this threat to human life, to the life of every species on the planet, to the planet itself. So thinking about it, I decided to write Bill McKibben, who was a co-organizer of 350.org, an international worldwide effort to stop the climate scorching of the planet. It's not global warming. Warming is nice. It's global scorching. To stop that, so as to save the planet, to write Bill McKibben and see what he thought about the notion of focusing these April dates. There were a couple more that are not official religious dates. One of them is April 4th, the Yahrzeit, the death anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King. So I got a letter back, just two lines from Bill McKibben saying, "That's very smart. Is it okay with you if I get in touch with Green Faith?" Now, Green Faith is a global interfaith organization about the climate crisis. I wrote back saying, "Sure." Green Faith said, "Hey, that's a great idea. And besides that, there are festivals of the Hindu community, the Buddhist community, and other communities in mid and late March and early May. So I came back to the question about Passover, glad that there was going to be a global religious response. So our national organizer, Nate de Groot, and I, and other staff, and some of the board of the Shalom Center, created by initiating and organizing a broader group called Exodus Alliance. Exodus Alliance, one word, .org. There's a whole complex of things. There are resources, information about the banks and other pools of money that invest in burning earth. So the hope is that we will have dozens of clusters of Jews, Christians, Muslims, maybe others as well, gather at Chase banks all over the United States. Chase Bank is practically ubiquitous, practically everywhere. There may be other places, BlackRock, that also make major investments in burning the earth. And the hope is that on the three intermediate days of Passover, not all of them, but one of them, that people appear at the doorways of those banks and do the new Freedom Seder, the Earth and Justice Freedom Seder, or a stripped down version of it if it feels too long. We're imagining people coming in costume as Pharaoh, as Mother Earth, as the golden calf, which gets connected with what it means to be freed at Sinai. So the idea is for people everywhere to demand that Chase Bank and other big pools of money that are being invested in death and fire, that they stop. And they not only stop, they move their money, protect our planet, and prosper our people. Move the money to where it serves life, not death. So that, I think, is where I want to end. I hope many of you will help to organize and take part in the exodus from plagues that plague not only human beings, but all of Earth, that threaten the destruction of the web of life on Earth. It will take many human beings to defeat and to change the carbon pharaohs so that they undertake a commitment to life. All of us can be the movement to make that happen. I welcome you to it. Shalom Aleichem again. Aleichem Shalom. And let us make a true shalom. It's not just peace, but wholeness, harmony among Adama, earth, and us human earthlings is what we really are. Adam. Adam and Adama. We fit into each other. It's time for us to make that fit peaceful, harmonious, and whole.